This is The Conversation. It's episode 143 with Priscilla Frank, arts writer for The Huffington Post, who covers the waterfront when it comes to art and pop culture, or culture, if you will. And so that gives us the opportunity to talk about everything from outsider art to Rihanna and Beyonce and everything in between. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where I highly recommend you go, particularly this episode, but for all episodes, because there are some great images of which I will tell you about. But you know, it's because we actually having a little more traffic from you other than the audio version is very helpful for us. So go check out theconversationpod.com, where you will see images of outsider artists. We talk about, that's one of the main topics we get into, which he writes about quite a bit. So images from the well-known Henry Darger, as well as people you may not have heard of, Joseph Joachim and Aloise Corbaz, as well as images by the young or Oakland-based artist Stephanie Sarley, who's blown up on Instagram, a couple of her images, and a couple viral images from the Huffington Post canon. And if that's not enough enticement, of course, images of Rihanna and Beyonce, who we talk about. But there is also, and we talk about this in The Conversation, a really amazing video from this band called Is Tropical, or Is Tropical, a British band, and their video for Dancing Anymore. I hadn't heard of the band or the song, so now I'm so familiar with them. But go check out that video. It's pretty amazing and will be good accompaniment to our conversation. Last episode we did was 142 with Kedar Brock, a Brooklyn-based abstract painter. Talk about his now successful career, making a living strictly from his work and how he got there and how that's being sustained. Good stuff. And I have received, by the way, some interesting feedback from you listeners on that episode, as well as the thought-provoking Michelle Grabner episode. So continue to enjoy hearing from you, and I hope this episode provides a lot of food for thought as well. I think we really cover the waterfront. And without further ado, let's get to this conversation with Priscilla Frank. Thank you so much for being here, and stay tuned for the back end where I will give you some more updates. All right, thank you so much for being here. Talk to you in the back end. Well, even though you're not at your home in Silver Lake, you're in the Valley currently, but you are, regardless, even if you were in Silver Lake at your home, you would be my my second local over the phone guest. So kind of an honor. Yeah, kind of an honor of sorts. But I wanted to,
I'm honored.
Yeah, good. Well, thank you for being honored. You write for the art section, and you can of course correct me as far as the titles and phrasing and whatnot, but you write for the art section of the Huffington Post. And
correct.
I think there's some interesting preliminary stuff to get into, or some context to get into about your venue, because I imagine a fair amount of people listening maybe associate art writing on the Huffington Post from their own experiences with people who do it voluntarily, you know, to connect to some other things that they write about, to their own art websites. It gives them a link back, I imagine, to their own the sites of their own art, that kind of thing. So I guess the first question is that something that even if maybe that's not how you arrived at Huffington Post, you're familiar with, and that you maybe have at various points needed to explain to people, no, actually, I'm a staff member of this publication.
Yeah.
And so on.
Yeah, definitely. If you go to the Huffington Post Arts website, like on the left, you'll see a rail that's the blog rail, which is all the contributing bloggers who sign up themselves, submit posts, and that is the blog page. And then everything on the middle and right rail with like the images is from staff writers. So that comes both from like the arts and culture page, and then sometimes other people who work for other sites on the Huffington Post who are you know, driven to write about a certain thing will contribute, but that's all like paid staff writers.
Right.
So it's really two separate sections, and like other sections of the Huffington Post are more community driven, like the parents page or education, or sometimes it's more of a like community conversation. And the arts page, I think a lot of times, yeah, it's people who are just driven to write about a show, or sometimes they'll, yeah, post other places and then cross post here. But there's a group of four editors who it's their job to cover shows every day.
And cover shows, did you say?
Or just cover arts and culture content.
Okay, so in other words, you're one of four?
Yeah, yeah.
And are you, correct. But are you, are your colleagues at all covering visual arts or fine arts or whatever, you know, sort of general section you want to describe it as?
We're arts and culture. So at one point in time, there was an arts page and a books page, and now they have merged. So two of us came from arts and two of us came from books.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's a little bit mixed, but I cover mostly visual art and some culture in terms of like performance, film, music every once in a while, but I mostly stick to visual art. And then there are definitely books experts who know far more about the contemporary book world than I.
Right. And are you, my sense is, and maybe this is, I'm not sure exactly, maybe I just want to give you this level of importance, but you are you at the beginning of being a professional, part of the professional arts writing team? In other words, was there anybody before you who covered fine art, visual art?
Yes. The page was started, I was one of the first people on the page, not like the first wave, but maybe the second or third wave.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been here now for almost 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the page has changed a lot and gotten a lot better and fuller and richer.
Mm-hmm.
When it started, it was really an experiment. And back then, it really was like far more of a platform, which would sort of like point people in the direction of different shows. And it was very Los Angeles centric because that's where it started. And now we do a lot more original content, a lot just, I mean, the page looks way better. There's like bigger images, just juicier stuff going on. So, I mean, I've been there for a while and seen it go through a lot of transition, but it existed before me.
But what about the Huffington Post? I mean, what was, you've been there a while, you know, and you obviously, it sounds like you got in pretty much right after college, right? So what was your perception of the publication? And, you know, what, maybe, I don't know if it's too politically dangerous for you to talk about that, like the pros and cons. Is that maybe something you don't, you would feel comfortable with, or?
For sure. I mean, the big thing that separates it is, like, it's very much outside of, like, the art world blog scene. And
right.
A lot of our readers aren't, you know, the, like, hardcore hyperallergic readers or, like, the culty Brooklyn art blogs. It's way more of a general audience, which is sometimes challenging, but mostly, I think, really exciting and a huge plus, just because it's sort of trust people into looking at art who wouldn't often look at it, and serves as like a first foray. And, you know, like one thing that I think I hear a lot and my coworkers hear that is a big compliment to us is just that everything we write is like really accessible and it's not in art world jargon. And I think that really wouldn't work for us. So,
right.
And we all try to tackle like challenging material, whether like I'm doing an abstract sculpture show or other people are doing more experimental books, and just sort of translate it into a language that is not just for people who this is their niche and this is their thing. And we are blessed to have like a really huge audience. And so sometimes that comes with crazy internet comments and just like all the weird stuff that comes with being a really massive site on the internet. But we operate a sort of a really small bubble within this massive machine. So it's a really nice mix of having a lot of creative control unto ourselves. Like there's a culture writer who really is very passionate about arts and culture and, you know, giving voices to women artists, artists of color. That's like our whole thing. And also about getting art to people who didn't go to art school, you know, don't know they're into it, and just be like, it's not hard to understand. It's not snobby. It's not like this thing that you're not welcome to. Here, take a look at this.
Yeah. You know what? One of the things that I was thinking as you were describing that is I actually prefer the kind of pieces that you do to many of these other sites that you sort of alluded to or just mentioned. I mean, I guess maybe I say
and
that.
Like, I love those sites and I read them all the time and they're
right.
Like, you know, I just think it's a different thing.
I think it maybe has a bit of an anti-intellectualism sort of kind of element to that comment that I made. But I guess maybe also what I was getting at is the Huffington Post is an institute. I mean, it's great, first of all, that you're reaching people who are not art snobs or not in the know in the art world or what have you. And it's great that you have a large audience, but I'm interested too in the Huffington Post as an institution. You know, there's obviously a lot of baggage there, and I guess that maybe is where it could be trickier for you to talk about. But if you have anything, I'd love to hear it.
I mean, I think like the main thing that we hear a lot, which like the main criticism, which I understand a lot too, is, you know, writers contribute without payment, but in a lot of cases it is like a mom telling her personal story in a way that she would post on her personal blog, and a lot of people read it and people share it, and it is like a conversation. Like, I don't think that it's the proper platform for someone who rigorously researches and spends a lot of time on a piece. Like, of course you deserve to be paid for that piece, and you should publish it elsewhere and also publish it on the Huffington Post, where it'll get shared a ton of times. You know, so I think like on the arts page, we would never like seek out a writer to do a rigorous piece unpaid for us. Like, if they're doing it for somewhere else, we would be like, publish it here too, we'll share it on our Facebook, we'll get eyes on it. Or if someone, you know, reaches out to us and has interest in publishing something and like wants to, that is fine. But I think it's a really great community on the pages where it works. And, you know, some content is right for it, some content is not. But I think that people don't understand really like that a lot of websites like BuzzFeed has a community section. Like, a lot of websites have an option for people to upload their own content without getting paid and to just like put their writing on the internet, which is cool. And the Huffington Post is really shit on for being the only place that does that. And, you know, they have a huge staff of paid writers and editors, and then they have a blog community that I think can get misunderstood and can be definitely exploited. But I don't think that most people who work here are trying to exploit people in that way.
Right. But to what extent is the clickbait aspect of the site sort of necessary for perpetuating the numbers, do you think?
I mean, working on the art site, which is really all that I can speak to, there are certain things that tend to do really well on our page, and most of those things I'm super happy to write about. Like, a lot are, you know, feminist photographers taking pictures of women of different body types, or stuff about gay rights, or stuff that has to do with politics. Like, the things that do well reach a lot of people. I think clickbait, you know, it's not like we're, or I wouldn't write something that I felt wouldn't be meaningful or like at least fun to read or look at for a wide variety of people. And I think, like, I'm definitely not someone who's judgmental about what that would be, but I think that a lot of times, like, what reaches a lot of people is meaningful in its own way, and I really am excited to write the more lowbrow content. Like, I just did someone who recreated scenes from Beyonce's Lemonade out of Legos, and, like, that's really sick. Like, it looks cool.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, you know, it's not going to be in the Met anytime soon, but I didn't feel like I looked at it and was like, holy shit, I would want to share this on Facebook. And I think there's a lot of that, of just like unabashed celebration of like the dumb and weird stuff on the internet, but sort of in a tongue-in-cheek way that I really enjoy and think is why people like to go on the internet. Like, it's just this huge all-you-can-eat buffet of weird stuff where like
right.
nothing is privileged and nothing is really off-bounds. So, I mean, I can't speak for the other pages, but I think everything that comes out is done from like a really tasteful point of view. And even if it's about to, like, I don't know, people really like to read all kinds of things, and they're just providing for their audience. I don't know.
Well, I just to clarify, I wasn't including any of your pieces in the category of clickbait, believe it or not. I don't know if that you misunderstood that part, but what
I have to get my numbers, and like
right.
I totally get it. Like, there's a lot of stuff that I do purely for the purpose of I think a lot of people will really like to read this, but that's also what brings me joy. Like, even if I do three sentences above a video that I think is really cool and I post it, and it's not like my most brilliant piece of writing and I didn't really have any huge insights on it, but you just see those numbers racking up and you're like, damn, I thought this was cool. A bunch of people really liked, you know, I think my most popular piece that I've ever written, at least for a long time, was this video of Hozier's Take Me to Church. That was like a David LaChapelle music video of a ballet dancer dancing, and I just wrote like damn on top or something. I mean, it was whatever, but
that's
it was
funny.
Just so popular, and it uh-huh. got my views for a really long time, and like I was sort of laughing because if that, you know, was my whole job, it would be a lot easier, but also it was just really moved people, and
right.
that's awesome.
Yeah No, I agree, and I'm with you, and I think all those things, and we'll talk about some of your pieces, including ones that are not maybe as popular as that, but definitely kind of in that mold. But just to give people listening, as well as you, a context for, or sort of more of a sketch of what I'm referring to, I've got two of your pieces up right now, okay? One of them is an introduction of an artist who we'll talk about later, and you scroll down it, and it's got your text, and it's got many, many images by this woman artist, and that's great. However, I look at another one of your pieces, okay, and it's a piece on Carolee Schneeman, the feminist magic of cat videos, and which is a great piece as well. And you scroll down that piece, and under suggested for you, this is what I'm talking about when I say clickbait. You've got mind-blowing Game of Thrones theory on Arya gets more support. This is Brock Turner's mugshot. Brock Turner's dad gave tone-deaf plea for lenient sentence in son's sexual assault case, etc. And there are like six more or so, maybe 10. In any case, you know, and I don't mean to put you on the defensive here. I just want to say that while you've got this great piece here, it's, not ideally paired with these clickbait things along the column on the side. So, you know, I understand. I think you already well articulated the sort of the realities.
Like,
yeah, go ahead.
It's similar to going to Facebook and looking on your right rail, and you see
right.
things that are trending. Like, that's
right.
what those stories are. It's what
right.
most people on the internet would like to read. And the more you go to the Huffington Post, the more it'll tailor that rail to things that you're interested in. Like, when I go, it's basically all art stories because I'm on the page all day.
Right.
I'm like, yeah, I'm interested in that. I wrote that story. But if it's if you're not that familiar with the site, it'll just hit you up with the biggest stories on our front page. And
that's what it was doing, because I'm not, they don't know me well enough yet. So they're like, hey, these are all the things you could check out.
Spend more time on the site, I think.
Right. Right. Okay. All right. Well, we're done. We're done with you being, put up on the stand for now. I wanted to just kind of get the HuffPost context covered first. So one of the first things that I want to talk about, which is something that you and I communicated about earlier, which is your coverage of, for lack of a better term, which is one you very, very in great detail address, is outsider art. And just to clarify, because I know you've done quite a bit of writing on it. Is it just another of many categories that you cover, or is it something that you cover like in a pretty large amount of your overall topics, would you say?
Yeah, I would say the latter. I think even from sort of what I was talking about a little bit before, of just the Huffington Post being outside of the regular domain of art blogs, I think I sort of was drawn to other fields of art that was sort of outside of the regular museum and gallery scene.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the Huffington Post is sort of an outsider, like through the root of being such a like behemoth website, but I still sort of felt, I don't know, like akin to covering things that were equally outside of the regular sphere of art. So I really loved writing about it. And also, I mean, just the way that it's spoken about, it's very story driven and like person driven. And I mean, obviously like super aesthetically interesting, but it was really in line with what I think of as the mission of the Huffington Post art site, which is just connecting art to people and giving voices to artists that like are often don't have a space yet on the internet.
Right. Did you go to the outside? You wrote about outsider art via the context of the Outsider Art Fair at the time that you wrote it, which I don't know if that was you know, in the past year. But did you go to the fair itself?
Yeah. We were the media sponsors of the fair, so we did a lot of stuff for it.
I see. Have you been to traditional art fairs as well?
Mm-hmm.
The reason I ask is
Miami a bunch.
Oh, got it. Okay, so I'd love to. I think people would be really curious to hear sort of what kind of comparisons would you make from having gone to the Outsider Art Fair to your typical Miami or whatever other regular art fair.
I mean, Miami is insane. I feel like, especially at the main fair, we used to do, this was like a couple of years ago, but we used to do entire stories that were just sound bites of crazy stuff that we heard people say walking around galleries and shows that were just like, you know, how much is this? Oh, I already have like another coon that would match. And just, I mean, it really just feels like another world, and it's super fun. And there's always people in fabulous outfits, and it's amazing and freakish to go.
Mm-hmm.
But the Outsider Art Fair, I mean, sort of as you would imagine, it feels like a cabinet of curiosities, and it's so much more intimate, and everyone, I mean, this year there was a blizzard, so everyone who was there was like really wanted to be there, and all the gallerists, you know, instead of like the cliche of people who work at galleries being super cold and like judgy and you know, sort of waiting politely for you to leave. Everyone just wants to tell you stories, and it feels like this very folky, around the campfire, exciting thing. I mean, I love it a lot. And I love art fairs too, but I think normally they are like this very freakish gathering of the art world. And the Outsider Art Fair just really feels like a small community in a way, where everyone is, I don't know, on the same page and weird and passionate in a similar vein.
Right. Yeah, it seems like that social or sociable aspect of it would make converts, you know, like of certain both collectors and just, art viewers. You know, getting that kind of vibe as opposed to, you know, maybe what you get at certain art fairs.
It's the easiest art to love, especially as someone who's not hugely ingratiated into the art world, just because every artist has such an insane life story, and in most cases art literally saved someone's life, and there's just so much emotion and passion in it, where it's not just someone coming out of art school and trying to make something that's marketable and in style. It's just like a story that will make you cry. You know, it's just really, it's very easy to become hooked on. And it's, or I said this in something that I wrote, but it really is just this very like mythical platonic idea of art as just someone, you know, making something, like creating their own world inside their head, and that swallowing up their whole existence and being their reason for living. And it's just this, it's what you want art to be, just this thing that changes lives and makes life worth living. And so if you get romantic about art, like, you are going to freak out when you hear any outsider artist story.
Right, right. Well, one of the things, you know, in reading your couple of pieces, if not more, I guess it was one sort of about the Artsider Art Fair in general, and then a couple of others about specific artists. One of the sort of theories that came to mind, speaking of what you're talking about, is one notable difference between outsider art and mainstream art is that with outsider art, it's the backstories of the artists that are explicitly tied in with them as artists, and maybe you could, if you want, this might sound a little cynical, but their brand as artists. Whereas with mainstream artists, it's more implicit, or even it's in some cases not relevant. So in other words, you see the work of the outside, a given outsider artist, and then you hear the story, or vice versa, or maybe you hear them, see the work and hear the story at the same time, as with the, you know, the pretty well-known Henry Darger documentary. And, you know, the work takes on this, you know, this very different tone than if you were to see it just on its own. So I don't know if that is something that you've
I think the difference, it's not that you need to know the artist story to appreciate the artwork, because you most certainly don't, but that's just sort of what will identify someone as an outsider artist, is just whether or not, you know, their lives place them in the art world and whether they're making art in conversation with the art world. So that's sort of how outsider artists are defined, but they couldn't be less concerned with branding themselves. Like, they don't even know a lot of the time that they're artists. So I would say they're not like, this is my story and this makes me an outsider artist and this is my brand. Like, it's so the opposite of that.
Right. Yeah, I was using the term brand. I mean, if that word is anywhere applicable at all, it would definitely not be coming from the artists themselves. It would be coming from, you know, either their gallerists or you know, the people that write about them, you know.
Like, outsider art is such a weird genre and even a weird term, because it's sort of just, it's like this catch-all term for artists that don't fit in other places. And I definitely don't think that you need to know their stories to appreciate their work, but you know, it's sort of, it certainly makes them interesting, like it does for all artists. And just the stories are often like extremely interesting in their own right. But if you look at a work of art, I was first drawn to them like purely aesthetically. And I think most gallerists would stand by that pretty hard, like would tell you the story, but definitely I think wouldn't believe in an artist who couldn't create work that stood on its own.
Right. Do you think if you were in a gallery, say, in a convention center, you know, a neutral sort of venue, and there were 10 works, and 5 of them were quote-unquote outsider artists, and 5 of them weren't, do you think you would be able to pass that test?
I don't know. I mean, contemporary art now is also so influenced by outsider art. Like, it's definitely coming into the cultural consciousness, like, in the past couple of years in a big way. And you can see in, like, a lot of recent exhibitions, you know, a lot of artists are very much inspired.
Do you want to drop any names here?
Practices. What?
Sorry, I said, do you want to drop any names here, since you're getting pretty specific?
Well, I mean, a lot of, like, there's one show in particular that I just found, but a lot, like, okay, so there's one exhibition, Character Traits, which was from 2015, at Icia Geisberg Gallery that I wrote a piece on that was like outsider art is now in the insider art world. And in that story, I referenced a show at the Sculpture Center, Puddle, Pothole, Portal, Heartbeats, Hard-Ons, and Freakouts at Marlborough Chelsea, Far Out at Marlborough Chelsea, Trenton Doyle Hancock at the Studio Museum in Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, Peter Saul is like a really good example, or even Mike Kelly, or there's only been artists for a while who are super inspired by this just sort of non-academic, very figurative and narrative, like freewheeling way of making art. A lot of, I mean, comics and cartoons are also really big right now, which sort of come from not quite outsider art, but like a very non-academic,
right,
outside of the institution perspective. So there was this show that I went to recently at the Good Luck Gallery in Los Angeles. Devron Richard, and he works at, he is would generally be qualified as an outsider artist. He makes work at a studio in San Pedro, and his work looks so much like someone like Irina Jurek, or who just does these sort of sensual cartoons that are very like humorous and irreverent and body. And so he's sort of the opposite, like someone who's an outsider artist who makes work that looks very mainstream. But then I think also a lot of artists, I mean, the original big one is Jean Dubuffet, who sort of was obsessed with these children and people in mental institutions, and really like capitalized on this idea of the unlearned artist. And then he very consciously created art that looked like that, and it was super successful. And I mean, artists are always, I think, you know, Picasso has a quote or something, it's like it's easy to draw, it's hard to unlearn how to draw, or like children are the best artists. Like, it's always been this sort of idea in art to learn how to draw so you can undraw it, and outsider art is just like the ultimate embodiment of that sentiment.
Yeah, there's something, one quotient among probably a few others, for me anyway, is the fucked up quotient, you know, that I think outsider art tends to bring, you know, pretty frequently. And sometimes, for me, again, I'm just speaking for myself here. I don't want to alienate you or any listeners, but I may. Sometimes it's a little too claustrophobic visually, you know. There's something... There are exceptions, but there's something like, I got to get out of here almost. I mean, it's not a literal feeling like I can't sit with this work. It's just there's something aesthetically it's maybe too intense, and maybe it has something to do with the fact that these artists, whether consciously or completely unconsciously, are tapping into this really unfiltered, you know, expression. And maybe we as sort of, you know, industry people, art industry people, are, you know, don't want the unfiltered. We want the filter, you know. That's what we, you know, go through school and, you know, and graduate school and all that for, the filters, you know. Like, you need a filter, you know, totally. So what somebody says in a crit class, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think I definitely, like, that's totally your aesthetic opinion. And, like, of course, I get it. Like, I think a lot of words that are associated with outsider artworks that, you know, don't always fit, but things like raw, crude, chaotic, obsessive, all these things, because for a lot of people, it really is like, it's either making sense of the chaos that they sense in their lives, or like a totally filled world that is as abundant and profuse and ever-growing as the real world. So it's definitely not like they're plotting out what's going to be like pleasing to a viewer or a buyer or anything. So I totally get it. I mean, I am someone who wears like a million bracelets and rings at all times.
So
I'm like, yeah, put it on. Like, the more colors, the better.
Right.
But I totally get it. I think, Yeah, I mean, for some people, it does look not that different from what a third grader would put on a refrigerator, which I also think is a lot better than a lot of art that I see in galleries. So
right.
That's just my taste.
Right, right, right. Do you have a favorite? You know, I don't want to say that you have to narrow it down, but I mean, is there somebody that's like your, oh yeah, I love that artist so much?
I mean, Joseph Joachim was the first artist that I saw that I really loved. And he is a Chicago artist who started doing these watercolor landscapes of places from his imagination that he had never been. And they're just, I mean, I'm surprised even that I love them so much when I first saw them, because I didn't really know anything about outsider art. And they're not super indicative of the genre. Like, they're pretty just like mellow watercolors, but there's just something about, like, they're not real places, but they sort of look how landscapes look in your memory, where you know you've been somewhere, but you sort of start to warp it in your mind and things sort of blend together. And just the way that you remember places that you've loved, and they sort of start to become this like idealized postcard image with particular details of where you've been. And so he's one that I really, really like. And then, oh my gosh, there's a million more.
Well, the guy you just mentioned, does he have a story that has stuck with you as well? Or is it really the work kind of regardless of his story that you think of?
Yeah, his was really the work. I don't know so much about him. I'm looking right now on his Wikipedia, and he left when he was 9 years old to join the circus. And it seems he traveled around for a while doing different circuses. He was in the army for a little while, and eventually he was committed to a psychiatric hospital and then worked in a coal mine. So
right.
That wasn't even something that I really knew. Like, this was, yeah, but he was like a big inspiration to the Chicago Imagist. So like, so he's been, I think he's one of, yeah, like the most famous and influential people, like Dimna and Gladys Nilsson and stuff.
Right.
Were super influenced by him. But yeah, I didn't even really know his life story until I looked it up on Wikipedia right now.
Right, right, right. Got it. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, just the reason the context that I asked that question is the Henry Darger story, you
mm-hmm.
know, which is such an amazing story. And for people who don't know, it's sort of the short, very short version. You can help me with it if necessary, is that this was somebody who made art on his own. He was a janitor, right? And he
mm-hmm.
made art
yeah.
just basically all night after hours for decades, you know, and his work wasn't discovered until after he died. And he was making these fantasies with, you know, I guess prepubescent girls, you know, in this sort of alternate universe, you know, and so just this sort of charge of that, solitary life and, you know, this world that he created, which I'm sure is a paradigm that you correct me if I'm wrong, that you see throughout the outsider art genre. But for me, that was just, I mean, it was such a fascinating story. And when I see his work now, you know, I kind of say, yeah, his work actually kind of does stand above the fray in the outsider arena. And that could just be, you know, the charm or, you know, the mystique of his backstory.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I agree in both ways. Like, his story is insane, but honestly, so are so many of them. Like,
right.
I think he is one of the main forces in outsider art and probably, like, one of the most valuable artists in the field. But in a way, with most artists, it's a little bit arbitrary. Like, his work is incredible, and he made, you know, like, a 16,000-page novel without anyone seeing it. He definitely is a spectacular human, but I think a lot of people could easily have taken that spot.
Right. Got it. Well, let's move to one of your, of the pieces that I've seen, one of the more intriguing and sort of art adjacent pieces, if you will. It's the one called F*K, or family friendliness, I suppose. So fuck your idols. What celebrity worship reveals about female sexuality, with the subtitle, when you don't know if you want to be her or be in her. So there's so much to talk about this piece. Maybe you can summarize it. But first, before you do, I want to give people this line that comes at the beginning. Well, I'll set it up, actually, just for a second. You talk about how you became sort of pseudo-sexually obsessed with Sandy from Grease, the movie, when you were 7, I think, and were describing her as maybe your first crush. And so in your description in early on in the piece, you say she was the first manifestation for me of that intense combination of lust, envy, and inspiration that makes ladies want to please a man so badly they can't stop desiring women. And then here's the line that I really wanted to get to. I call such objects of desire sex muses and imagine them as the contemporary feminist response to Socrates and all the young hot pupils he inspired and banged. So people who are taking philosophy right now, you know, they should be aware of that side of Socrates.
Yep.
So this is one of the benefits of being able to cover kind of more, it sort of address more mainstream phenomena of your writing.
Yes. Yeah. There's on the Culture Page every Wednesday or Thursday, there's a column called Middle Brow, which I don't normally do, but it's like a pop cultural phenomenon that's just sort of either a rant or musing or something. And this week I felt particularly inclined to talk about Sandy and Rihanna, so I asked if I could contribute.
Okay. So this was pretty recently?
Yeah, I think maybe a couple months ago.
Okay. Yeah, that's that's recently. Yeah. Right. So where do you want to begin with this? I mean, I could get into some specifics from the piece, but well, first of all, I want to take the opportunity to alert listeners to a video that you sort of describe and also deconstruct, which I was not aware of, but it's this band called Is Tropical, and the video is Is Dancing Anymore, which I don't know how much we should give away, but it's, let's just say it's a, are they a French band, by the way? Because obviously it's a French setting.
Think so. Okay. I don't know though.
So because the people in the video are speaking French, and so it's this boy who's probably, do you think he's like 12 or 13?
About.
You said he was, I think you've referred to him as prepubescent, but I don't know. I mean, he's right around.
Yeah, the band's from England. I just looked it up.
Okay, got it. So this I'm trying to cut to the chase, which is this boy basically gets to house it for this woman. He's both supposed to clean her pool and then house it, but he ends up having this sort of big masturbatory sexual fantasy that involves all these virtual reality women and whatnot, and there's an orgy at one point, and then it gets really weird. I'm just trying to give people the main takeaway before we get into more detail, but it's these are the kinds of videos that, being not much of a clickbait person, I'm missing out on. You know, I mean, this is amazing, and it's kind of amazing to look at the culture in this way. And I think
have to let go of this idea of clickbait.
Okay,
it's only an illusion that's holding you back.
Right. No, I don't. I'm not trying to. I'm not trying to continue to bash on HuffPost.
Totally,
that's not what I was doing. I think I was referring to the fact that I'm not, you know, checking out a lot of videos online. And there's some very avant-garde stuff, I suppose, that I don't know. Do you agree in this case?
In this video?
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. So why don't you help me tie it back in your piece to, you know, the sexuality and, you know, and the Rihanna model and so on?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I originally, there's one quote in the piece that was about one woman talking about feeling like she was a Beyonce sexual that I included in the piece, but I read her article and that's what sort of gave me the whole idea. But she was just talking about how, like, the straightest kinds of women, their true fantasy is to have sex with Beyonce because she is, you know, every man's object of desire. And so you sort of have this weird amalgam desire to both want to be her and want to fuck her. And it just sort of becomes something more powerful than having a crush on a guy could ever be, because it's sort of bound up with both what you want for yourself and what you want for your partner. And I really identified with that just because I am a straight-ish person with a very serious boyfriend. But, like, if you ask me who my celebrity crushes are, they are all women. And Rihanna, who I talk about a lot. But, you know, I'll just look at her pictures all the time and obsess over them. And obviously, a lot of that is just because she's a goddess and the hottest thing ever. But I also thought there was just interesting weird thing that girls get programmed into feeling from a young age, where you just become enamored with these women who seem so adept at seducing men and having sex with men and pleasing men, and so you both want to emulate them, but then it becomes like such a fierce desire that it ends up overpowering the real object of your desire. And I, you know, connected it to John Berger, has that wonderful book that's relevant to everything about right. how women are just always watching themselves. And I talked about just how over time it sort of turns from this point of like patriarchal oppression, where women, you know, want to be liked by men so badly that they're not even looking at the men anymore. They're looking at other women. But then it sort of morphed into this point of like queer, weird awesomeness, where you end up desiring, you know, like your sexual experience is so much more multifaceted than just desiring a man. It's sort of like shaping yourself and who you want to be in a sexual encounter and desiring them and including all of these other presences. So
do you think
the video, I think, was just to show mm-hmm. how the guy, when he's thinking of having sex with these hot avatar
women, right?
Whatever, video game-ish right. women, yeah, he still looks exactly the same, where if right. I were to, like, imagine my sexual fantasy, like, I would look amazing, and
you
I would definitely think about how I looked in the encounter.
You would be Beyonce or Ariana. In your fantasy,
yeah, yeah,
maybe
yeah,
right, right. Do you think one of the things that I was wondering as you're describing that piece is, do you think maybe what the piece is about and maybe the way through people like Rihanna and the way that, you know, the selfie culture or just the empowered growing up with these types of role models culture, that women are potentially reshaping the sort of Berger, John Berger like philosophy into being able to be seen and be objects of men and other people, but to take sort of be empowered in that position at the same time, as opposed to just an object.
Yeah, like I think object is bad, like nobody wants to be perceived as an object, but to be seen in like all of the complexity and beauty that you have, like, for sure, that's super empowering. And like, that's why I, you know, on Rihanna on Snapchat, she is like super raw and real and nasty and weird. And I think she, you know, it's not these, and I think that's what's cool about videos of celebrities versus photos of them. Like, even that is such a small step, but it really like breaks down the facade in such a real way, and you just I feel like just watching someone move or laugh, like, it just seems so much more accessible than a glossy photo. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously men are going to look at women no matter what, but I feel like it's just the object word is super fucked up.
When you wrote this piece, did you kind of have it all figured out sort of emotionally or philosophically about yourself beforehand? Or I kind of suspect from what you said earlier, one thing you said earlier, that maybe it was kind of a learning experience to write about this and you know, that it was a way of seeing yourself and other women as well in a different way.
I worked through it a little bit more when I was writing it. Like, I definitely had always just accepted about myself that all of my crushes were in the fantasy realm were girls, and in reality were mostly boys, but and just, you know, took that as like, whatever, people are more than one thing and complex. But I do think looking at the celebrity element and just the relationship that women have to other women, where I do think there's just so much, especially growing up, like, you really are just looking at other women as, you know, almost works of art. Like, a lot of time goes into creating yourself and how you want to look and be and act and move in the world. And so when you just see how other women operate, like, it's always very fascinating to me. And whereas, like, men, it often just seems like they didn't have to think about it that much because people just accept them how they are. So you're just like, okay, this guy's walking down the street in nasty jeans and like hunched over, and that's fine. But with a girl, you can just really see that she's, I mean, not always, of course, but often, like, she's made herself how she wants to be, and like, a lot of effort goes into that, and it can be really inspirational and interesting and more fun to look at.
Yeah, yeah. We actually were, you know, fairly recent episode, a guest and my often co-host Deb Cloudman and I were talking, and the guest brought up Beyonce, and Deb was very enthused, and I was a little bit like, where is this going? But yeah, I bring that up because she, and Deb actually said Michael is horrified right now. But I bring that up because I think that what you just said a moment ago about, you know, there being an art to them. I mean, I think it's an interesting, you know, sort of alternative paradigm to consider about art, you know, that, and I think there are probably a lot of Beyonce fans among, you know, art world women, I would imagine. I don't think Deb was alone by any stretch. You know, I don't know. I'm not sure exactly where I'm going with this, other than I'm trying to draw a through line between something so popular with art, which, you know, is obviously sort of a much more connoisseur heavy, refined, and, you know, and obviously much smaller sort of niche. But there is some. How would you describe the crossover or the through line?
I mean, Lemonade was a work of art.
There you
go. As far as I'm concerned.
Right, right.
And I think, you know, women have been looked at and objectified and demeaned in across pop culture for most of history. And I think art is a wonderful example of that. You know, like, the Gorilla Girls say this all the time, but women are so much more included in the art world as naked bodies in
right.
paintings than as creators. So I, you know, I wouldn't want to like totally celebrate that, but I also think there is something that potentially empowering about just the level of attention and creativity that a lot of women have unfortunately felt pressured to put into themselves, but ends up creating something really beautiful.
Mm.
And yeah, I mean, Beyonce is, I mean, I am so not one to distinguish like highbrow, lowbrow. Like, I'm a huge fan. I think she's one of the best performance artists of our time, and she's incredible and a wonderful role model for women, for sure.
Mm, right, right. Yeah, that must be nice, being able to be an omnivore, a cultural omnivore, right? Because, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure where I'm going with this either, but you don't have to, you can sort of take in everything. And I don't know, for me, and I guess I'm going to, I don't know if I can throw myself under the bus, actually. I accused a guest once who said, you know, I'm going to throw myself under the bus. And I said, you can't throw yourself under the bus. Somebody has to throw you under the bus. So I'm going to do whatever the equivalent of throwing myself under the bus is. And I'm going to say that I tend to take a very snobbish view towards things that are really popular. You know, that's why I was, in fact, horrified by, you know, this mention of Beyonce and so on. You know, and generally, I mean, I think I don't think it's hard to make an argument that most pop music today really is bad, for whatever that's worth. But I think what you just described, though, a moment ago, is that, you know, you don't have much of a sort of biased filter as far as digesting or you know, taking on what the culture has to offer, you know, and you can therefore enjoy the fruits of brilliance in whatever particular category, you know, artificial category they come in.
And I mean, I think like so much of even the highest of highbrow that depends so much on these ideas of like simplicity and repetition are so prominent in pop music, or I just feel like it's all catered to a different audience, but like of the same recipe, sort of.
Right, right.
My job has definitely had a big influence, but it's really nice to see just things that genuinely move people, because that's what all this stuff is here to do, you know? And so it's hard not to acknowledge something like Beyonce, where she just clearly has like such a much wider influence on young women and everybody than most museum shows. And I mean, it's not like one's better than the other, but I just, popularity, I think, is such a plus, not a minus. Or else you're just saying something so sad about like most people, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's a extremely important point, and it's one that I think we sort of were talking about kind of in a specific way when I spoke with the art writer Ben Davis not too long ago. The sort of one of the things that I was asking him about is, you know, to what extent art filters down, you know, trickles down is the expression, because we're, you know, one of the pieces that he had, one of the philosophies that he had in his 9.5 theses had to do with trickle down economics and maybe trickle down education. And so I was asking about trickle down art. You know, does fine art ever really trickle down out into the larger sphere? And essentially, without getting into this, the nuances, the answer was no, you know.
I think for sure.
Well, okay. Well, we can get into that. But the reason that the way that I was setting that up is that indeed, pop cultural people, including Beyonce, among others who are you know, much less talented and creative, you know, are the culture that are impacting, you know, the youth the most, you know, and fine art does not really have a role in that regard. But yeah, but go ahead with your counter argument about what I was saying before.
I mean, since we're talking about Beyonce, like her, like Lemonade, the video Hold Up, They Don't Love You Like I Love You is like a direct take on Pippolotti Riff, one of her pieces.
Oh,
where
wow.
She's bashing in the cars. The windows of cars.
Right.
Yeah, and that's just like, and I mean, sometimes it's done, like sometimes artists, you know, are celebrated as paying homage to to fine artists, sometimes it's more they're ripping them off. Like, she's definitely also been accused of taking choreography from, like, more alternative choreographers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Rihanna had a thing a while ago of, like, taking stuff from, like, the C-punk internet artists that weren't getting paid or acknowledged for their work. So I think it's not always done with class and isn't always a positive, but I definitely think that those things, yeah, I mean, I think fine artists most often who are on the pulse of, you know, they're like capturing in their work what reality looks like now, and that always translates into pop culture a little late.
Right. That's a very good point. Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. So in some cases, or in many cases, whether it's a commercial or a band, say a video or something else, an avant-garde artist, I don't know if that sounds a little too heavy-handed, that the use of that adjective, but a fine artist's work or choreography or idea has been basically taken, lifted for somebody else's more popular project and has benefit from it.
Sometimes, yeah.
Sometimes.
Hopefully.
Right, right.
Yeah. Or they're really pissed and ripped off feeling.
Well, I think this other piece of yours maybe is a good kind of a more democratic or sort of less, more bi-directional than unidirectional cultural phenomenon, which is the piece that you did on Carolee Schneeman, the performance artist, and her passion for cats. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, there's the pussy, and, you know, she did a number of photographs and videos using her cats and, I guess, sort of very intimate ways and whatnot. And without getting the point that the sort of comparison or the leap that I was trying to make from our prior topic was the fact that that the art world, as you pointed out, has kind of, in a modest way, or in modest amounts, has taken on the explosion of cat video culture vis-a-vis the show the festival that the Walker Museum has been doing of internet mm-hmm. cat videos. And then you mentioned a couple of shows, the cat art show and another cat show. I don't know if you remember where those were from, but I don't know. I guess I'm trying to set this up to be much more of a, you know, we can share our respective cultures. You know, they don't have to be, you know, from high to down low and what have you.
Yeah, and a lot of them are from, like, these archetypal roots, or, you know, like, Balthus painted women and cats all the time.
Right.
And cat videos are obviously making they've had this new form since YouTube evolved, but I feel like there's always been a connection with, like, black cats and witches, or, you know, I mean, Carolee specifically talks a lot about the very feminine, indeterminate nature of cats, which I really like. Like, they're very soft, but then all of a sudden they have claws and they sort of move around very sensually, but don't show you their feelings. They're not forthcoming like dogs, and it makes people uncomfortable. And in this way that it really resonated with femininity and what makes people uncomfortable about femininity. And I loved, you know, that was something that I had never really said as eloquently as she said it to me, and not something I would ever think myself in watching a cat video. But, you know, if you look at the Queen of Wands tarot card, there's a black cat on it. Like, I think cats always have been associated with femininity and feminine power in this way that people pick up on and, like, elaborate on in different ways at different times, but it's sort of always been there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. At the end of your piece on her, you talk about Googling cat videos as you were taking a breather from writing the piece, and you landed on one called Best Mom and Cute Cat Family. And as I ended the piece, I see this other video, which I'm pretty sure is not that one because it's from Giphy. And it's this one cat massaging this other cat, which may or may not be its child. But I don't know. That's just it's a very fascinating piece.
Yeah, that cat being massaged is me for sure.
Yeah. What were you going to say before?
I just loved that video so much and I connected to it.
Right. But the other piece that you did, you know, we may get to another, who knows. But one other that I definitely wanted to highlight was your piece on You Can Start a Small Revolution Just by Drawing a Vagina, which is a really textually short piece, but then it's got tons of images by this woman who I'm going to guess is, if not a friend, definitely an acquaintance of yours, named Stephanie Sarley, who is an artist in Oakland.
Not really. I mean, I was a fan of her work on Instagram and read an article on her work by on The Guardian by this guy Sam Lefebvre.
Mm-hmm.
And but I didn't know her before I wrote the piece, so she was very friendly, and I felt bonded with her in our interview conversation,
which was over the phone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it was that Guardian piece that where you first discovered her work?
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Well, it's interesting because I was one of the things that I was curious about is how you discovered her. I mean, I was not aware of her work, and she seems to be, and this is something that I think you could speak to quite a bit, an artist who is very much a crossover phenomenon in terms of being a fine artist and also a social media sort of, I don't know if celebrity is the right word, but a social media phenomenon. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, these videos, just to give listeners a heads up, I only seen the one that was on the piece, which was embedded in the piece you did of the grapefruit. But I can imagine that these sort of sexualizing fruit videos that she puts on Instagram. I mean, of the one that I saw, which is great. I'm sure the others are great too. I mean, these are like, this is such a simple and yet brilliant. This is like,
yeah.
This is like the
it's
Warhols.
Perfect, yeah.
This is like the Warhols Campbell soup cans, you know, all over again. Yeah. It's like the perfect idea that nobody had thought to actually do. And then she finally has done it.
You see it. You're just like, of course.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Why didn't I do that?
Right.
It's so brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. Is there anything else though that you, want to say about like either her? Well, I mean, we should say that she, in your conversation with her anyway, is very vehement about wanting to change the conversation, you know, in a Gorilla Girls sort of way, as far as changing the numbers and getting more women artists recognized.
Yeah, I mean, that's my whole job. That's all I really am trying to do, which, I get excited when, I mean, almost any women artist will say that because they're dealing with it like way more than I am, and it sucks so much. But yeah, I mean, if that is just such a more innovative and exciting and beautiful and weird way to encounter a vagina in art than like a coy nude touching, essentially covering herself up because it's not appropriate.
Right.
Like that is, I mean, just like, it's such a simple democratic action to just put your finger in a fruit and upload it onto Instagram. And then just by virtue of that, like, yeah, I mean, it's just such a powerful and simple action and just done in such a, like, not snobby way. I don't know. I'm so into her. I think she's amazing.
Yeah.
And
what is her work doing as far as, you know, galleries and institutions? I mean, she's obviously very young still, but is she making waves in more of the high art world as well, or do you know?
I don't know so much in terms of, like, she's definitely, her fruit thing got like a lot of press coverage for sure.
Yeah,
but I don't know how much she's being paid for it. I hope a lot.
Right.
I know, like, Jerry Saltz is into it, which I think was, I'm sure, a big deal.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at her website right now, and it still looks like most of her shows have been at, like, pretty grassroots place in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
So people should get on that because she's awesome.
Yeah. So you said a moment ago, this is really a really interesting point, that important point, that you, this what she said is what you're trying to do too. You're trying to change the numbers. So I guess we could go a number of different ways with that, but I suppose the first one would be the first thing that comes to mind for me is, so when you have an opportunity to write about a sort of a emerging artist or even an established artist, are you going to at all costs be sure that if it is a man, that it, you know, it really is an exceptional man? Or, you know, how do you think about that process as far as decision making?
I'm a white woman, so I'm not like the be all end all of diversity, but I think that when I'm just looking at things that speak to me and appeal to me and are interesting to me, a lot of what comes out to me happen to be by, like, people other than white male artists, like, pushing the boundary of
paint.
Whatever.
Right. Abstraction.
Artistic argument that I don't really care about.
Yeah,
So a lot of it is, like, I am lucky to have the job that I have, and I'm picking things that I like as a young woman with weird taste. So it's not entirely, like, an agenda, but also... Yeah, I mean, I think that would put, like, a lot of people think of us as sort of the man or something. And if you look at our page, it's a pretty, like, you'll be hard pressed to find a white male artist on there just because of what we're into. And I'm so proud of that. And it's not even, I mean, it's certainly something that we try to do, but also we're just showing things that we're excited about genuinely. And I think it's like a pretty radical, like, smorgasbord, honestly. It's definitely something that is both important to me, but I'm not consciously thinking about it every second, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. When we sort of at the beginning, when we were talking about HuffPost and, you know, and traffic and so on, I'm interested in, you just kind of mentioned it in passing before, but some articles really get a lot of comments. I don't know if the ones that I've seen are just not particularly high traffic ones, or maybe some of the comments have been edited out, but what are some of your memories or takeaways from, like, the really high traffic pieces? And, like, have you, do you have to sort of be careful about what you engage in that kind of thing?
I don't really engage with commenters a lot because I just get anxiety and it freaks me out, and we're too fast paced of a page, so I just can't.
Sure.
I mean, there's definitely a huge breach in, there's a huge difference between articles that go on the front page of, like, the HuffingtonPost.com. Like, I mean, the most obvious example of that would be, of course, the artist who drew Donald Trump with the micro penis, who, was beat up and insanely abused for her freedom of expression. But on our page, it went super viral, which means a ton of people saw it and a lot of people commented on it. And yeah, I got a lot of comments just saying, like, when Donald Trump is president, you'll get what you'll deserve in rotten hell.
Those
comments are, like, definitely easy to not care about, and
right,
you know, thoughtful engage. It's normally either thoughtful engagement and criticism, which I am so happy to read and think about, and in email I'll respond, in comments I normally don't, and a lot of it is stuff that I can easily push out of my brain and just be sad that those people exist.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Priscilla, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
This is really
fun and very cool. I really appreciate you asking me.
Absolutely. And we're out. Thank you very much again to Priscilla for talking to me. And for being so thoughtful on all of those various topics. And to give you a little update, about the time or shortly after this comes out, she will be heading back to New York. She's been in LA for the last few years, but back to the crew, the headquarters of the Huffington Post art section. And so she'll be able to take advantage of all New York has to offer. Thank you guys so much for being here. And I hope you went and checked out those images on the site. Want to let you know that this is a listener-supported show. There were no advertisements in this episode, and we depend on your support, ideally financial, to continue this show, continue production. So if you go to theconversationpod.com/support, you can leave a nice donation there for $12, $20, $30, $50, $100, etc. Be very much appreciated. Of course, you can also support the show. It would be very much appreciated if you could turn a friend onto the show that you think might be interested. And of course, you can follow the show on social media. That is very much appreciated, at Artist Podcast on both Instagram and Twitter. And of course, you can like the show on Facebook. And again, I have been alluding to the fact that when you are the one who hits that 1,000th fan on Facebook, you will be entitled to something special. So if you haven't liked the show already, you know, we're getting close and you could be the one. All right. Thank you very much again for being here. I hope you enjoyed that. I'm always interested in hearing what you have to say. I've had some very interesting feedback from the recent episode with Kedar Brock, as well as the very thought-provoking episode with Michelle Grabner before that. So always love to hear from you. Let us know what you thought about outsider art, pop culture art, etc. Love to hear from you. Thank you very much, and I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.